Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. In a bold move, this is from the Wire Service, in a bold move to end the controversy over the sacking of 8 United States attorneys, President George W. Bush today offered the fired prosecutors what he called exciting new positions in Iraq. With the president facing pressure from Congress over the firing of the attorneys and funding of the continuing war effort, Mr. Bush told reporters at the White House that sending the surge of 8 U.S. attorneys to Baghdad was a win-win solution to both problems. Mr. Bush said, Congress has been trying their damnedest to limit my ability to prosecute this war. Excuse me, darndest. Well, I can think of no one more qualified to prosecute this war than those 8 prosecutors. Mr. Bush said that dispatching a surge of lawyers to Baghdad will be sending a strong message to insurgents and terrorists that they can no longer take the law into their own hands. Said Bush, I have strongly felt for some time that we need more suits on the ground. If all goes as planned, the 8 prosecutors will be parachuted into Baghdad as early as this Wednesday, Mr. Bush told reporters, and could be prosecuting insurgents by Thursday. While some of the White House press corps questioned if sending 8 prosecutors to Iraq would really be enough to turn the tide of the war effort there, Mr. Bush said he already has plans to send additional lawyers if necessary. If those aren't enough, he said, I'll send Gonzalez. Oh, well, thanks to Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com, the source of that, and used with the permission of Mr. Borowitz, obviously tongue-in-cheek. But there is something really large here, something very, very significant going on with this whole Gonzalez Gate situation. And it's, in a way, emblematic of and meta to something much larger, and in a way it is in and of itself a crisis, if not, you know, possibly a crime. I mean, you've got Chuck Hagel over in the current issue of Esquire magazine, using the I word, impeachment. Say what? Chuck Hagel. Yes, the Republican Chuck Hagel. So what's this all about? Over at the Hard Rain Journal blog, words-of-power.blogspot.com, the 4 blockbusters which have not yet hit, having to do with the DOG purge, Purgegate, maybe this should be called, or Gonzalez Gate. I call it Gonzalez Gate. Maybe it should be called Purgegate. In any case, I was over the weekend browsing. I know this sounds totally geeky, okay, so I should apologize in advance, but this is what I do for fun. What can I say? I was reading the proceedings of the House of Representatives from 1789. What can I say? Okay, so it was, and there was this debate. This was on 17 June, 1789. You can actually find it online. It's where I tracked it down. And I was looking for some of Madison's debates, James Madison's debates, on whether or not the president should be able to fire somebody like a U.S. attorney. Should the president have the ability, should he have the power to fire somebody that he appointed? Because this is one of the major talking points, one of the major Republican talking points is, well, you know, these guys serve at the pleasure of the president. You've heard that phrase at least 1,000 times. Well, I serve at the pleasure of the president. They serve at the pleasure. He serves at the pleasure of the president. At the pleasure of the president. I mean, John Stewart did a comedy bit on it. So the debate that they were having, now keep in mind, on June 17th, 1789, in April, I forget the date, I think it was April 14th, it might have been the 16th, in mid-April, George Washington of 1789, George Washington was sworn in as president. So we have been a country for 3 months, you know, officially, legally, our first president, our first Congress. We've been a country for 3 months. And George Washington appoints Thomas Jefferson to be Secretary of State. So the question comes before Congress, how do we create a State Department that Thomas Jefferson can be the head of? And should George Washington have the power to fire people in Thomas Jefferson's State Department, particularly those people who he has appointed, like, for example, Thomas Jefferson, or any of the employees who require confirmation? See, all this goes back to the Constitution. They had just ratified, just months earlier, they had ratified the Constitution, or maybe actually it was a few months later, but in any case, the Constitution was here before them. Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution says, the President shall have the power, by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, to make treaties provided two-thirds of the senators present concur, and he shall nominate, and by and with the advice and consent of the Senate shall appoint ambassadors, other public ministers and consuls, judges of the Supreme Court, and all other officers of the United States whose appointments are not herein otherwise provided for, and which shall be established by law. Okay, so basically they're saying people like the federal prosecutors, they have to be appointed by the president, but they have to be confirmed by the Senate. So there was this debate, this fascinating, it was just a fascinating debate in Congress about, okay, the president appoints these guys, these prosecutors. I mean, in the case of this debate, it was within the State Department, but the effect is the same. They were talking basically about, let's establish a precedent for agencies within the executive branch, whether it's the Justice Department or whether it's the State Department or whether it's the War Department or whatever. Let's establish a precedent for whether or not the president can fire people that he has appointed. And there were some people who were arguing that, well, hey, the president appointed them, and the Senate confirmed them. So in order for them to be fired, it should take an action of both the president and the Senate. And Madison says, no. If you do that, you're creating a two-headed monster. He said that would not be a good thing. That would be, you know, highly undesirable. He literally used the phrase two-headed beast or two-headed monster somewhere in this. I've got this whole long debate here, but it's I don't want to bore you with reading long chunks of it. Others suggested that the president should be able to fire. Elders Gerry, for example, the congressman from Rhode Island, who was one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence along with Madison, said that. Actually, I'm not sure if Madison was one of the signers of the Declaration. He was certainly, I believe he was. He was certainly the father of the Constitution. In any case, Elders Gerry said that the president, he says, this is ridiculous. And in fact, you know, it was almost that phrase. He said, it is said, well, actually, I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me just back up a little bit. Elders Gerry said, no. Now, the president should be able to fire him. But Madison says, no, the president shouldn't be able to fire them unless he has cause. See, here's the question was, what happens if he fires somebody who is a good person, a meritorious officer? What about wanton removal of a meritorious officer? And the bottom line is that Madison said that this should be something for which a president, well, here's his exact phrase. He says, the danger then consists merely in this. The president can displace from office a man whose merits require that he should be continued in it. What will be the motives which the president can feel for such abuse of his power and the restraints that operate to prevent it? In the first place, he will be impeachable by this House before the Senate for such an act of maladministration. For I contend that the wanton removal of meritorious officers will subject the president to impeachment and removal from his own high trust. Now, that's James Madison on the floor of the House of Representatives in 1789, saying, you know, at that point in time, by the way, there were no federal crimes, even though the Constitution said the president could be impeached for high crimes and misdemeanors. So it was a rhetorical phrase, high crimes and misdemeanors. It wasn't defined. So here's Madison defining for the first time one of the high crimes for which the president could be impeached. What is it? Firing somebody like a federal prosecutor in a wanton fashion, somebody who is, you know, a good person. Very interesting. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
Listener-supported radio here, the Tom Hartman Program, supported by you, our listeners, listening to your local radio station for the sponsors that are keeping this program on the air and letting them know that you're listening and letting them know that you're buying their products and recommending them to your friends. That, as well as our national sponsors like SacredGroundsCoffee.com, SmallDog.com, the Organic Wine Company, Eco 1888 Eco Wine, and Purina One Natural Blends. You can give them a call for their cat food at 866-380-MEOW for a free 3.5-pound bag. Anyhow, welcome back, and thanks for supporting the program. This isn't about whether or not the president can fire somebody who works in the executive branch. This is about whether he can wantonly remove a meritorious officer. This is whether he can fire somebody for political purposes. Back in 1789, that was referred to as the wanton removal of a meritorious man. And this is the quote from James Madison. The wanton removal of meritorious officers would subject the president to impeachment and removal from his own high trust. Now, after Madison gave his speech, Eldridge Gerry of Rhode Island gets up. And this is a guy who nearly lost everything in the Revolutionary War. He was one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. And fled his home, came back. It was in rubble. He nearly lost everything. He's now in the House of Representatives in 1789. He said, "It is said," this is by Mr. Madison, "that the president will be subject to an impeachment for dismissing a good man. This, in my mind, involves an absurdity." Now, the absurdity Congressman Gerry pointed out, was that if the president was to dismiss a good man, he would then have to appoint another person who would be subject to confirmation by the Senate. And once the Senate had that new person in front of them, they could raise inquiry into why the old person was dismissed and what the nature of the new person was if somebody was trying to replace a good person with a political hack. And so Gerry says, you know, there's no here. There's no problem here because there's this check and balance built in that the president can't appoint somebody without the Senate's overseeing it. Therefore, it doesn't matter if he fires somebody because he's not going to do it. No president would be stupid enough to engage in what the honorable congressman from Virginia, Mr. Madison, calls the wanton removal of meritorious officers. No president would be foolish enough to do that because he would have to confront the Senate again. Mr. Gerry, the congressman from Rhode Island, of course, had not foreseen a day when a certain Senator Specter would be forced to hire a right-wing operative by ideologues in the White House. That operative would then slip into law over Senator Specter's name, but according to the good senator without his knowledge, a change in the constitutional requirement of Senate confirmation of presidential appointments to the position of federal prosecutors known as U.S. attorneys. In his wildest dreams, he did not imagine that. Eldridge Gerry. He said, it's inconceivable. And yet, it happened. It took 230 years. But it happened. This is the actual title of the debate. The House went into a committee on the whole on the bill for establishing the Department of Foreign Affairs, that's the State Department, and resumed the consideration of the clause, quote, to be removable by the president, end quote. Mr. Madison is called upon to speak. And then he starts out, the decision that is at this time made will become the permanent exposition of the Constitution. In other words, we're setting a precedent. And on a permanent exposition of the Constitution will depend the genius and character of the whole government. It will depend perhaps on this decision whether our government shall retain that equilibrium which the Constitution intended or take a direction toward aristocracy or anarchy among the members of the government. I warn you, Mr. Chairman, I'm quoting James Madison here now. I warn you, Mr. Chairman, that I feel great anxiety about this question. I feel an anxiety because I am called upon to give a decision in a case that may affect the fundamental principles of the government under which we act and liberty itself. Several constructions have been put upon the Constitution relative to the point in question. The gentleman from Connecticut, Mr. Sherman, has advanced a doctrine which was not touched on before. He seems to think, if I understood him right, that the power of displacing from office is subject to legislative discretion. Because of having a right to create, it may limit or modify it as thought proper. In other words, the congressman from Connecticut says, well, you know, the Senate can fire them. They confirmed them. And Madison goes on to say, when I consider the consequences of this doctrine and compare them with the true principles of the Constitution, I own that I cannot subscribe to it. He disagrees. And then he says, the doctrine that seems to stand most in opposition to the principles I contend for is that the power to annul an appointment is in the nature of things incidental to the power which makes the appointment. That is the president. And then he goes on to say, you know, but the president can do it. He says the three great departments of government must be kept separate and distinct, and if any case they are blended, it is in order to admit a partial qualification in order to more effectively guard against an entire consolidation. Bottom line, the wanton removal of meritorious officers would subject the president to impeachment.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on the radio support group of By and For We the People. This was in 1789. June 17th, 1789. Okay, the Republic was just 6 months old. The President George Washington had been in office 3 months. And resolutions, this from Sidney Howard Gay in 1898 wrote a book called James Madison. And he says resolutions were to create the executive departments of foreign affairs, that would be the Department of State, of Treasury, and of War, were offered by Mr. Madison. These were required in general terms by the Constitution with a single officer at the head of each to be appointed by the president with and by the advice and consent of the Senate. The manner of the appointment of subordinate officers was provided for by the Constitution, but the manner of their removal from office was not. Was the tenure of office to be of good behavior, to be good behavior? In other words, do they stay as long as they behave well? Were the incumbents removable with or without cause? The Constitution doesn't say. If the power of removal existed, did it vest in the power that appointed, that is the president, and Senate conjointly, or in the president alone? And so in 1898, Howard Gay is writing about what happened in 1789. And he says, as the Constitution was silent, the question had to be settled on its own merits. With all the arguments that could be urged, either on one side or the other, we are familiar enough in our time coming up with the question, and so often does changes in state constitutions and municipal charters. There is this essential difference, however, between now and then. We now know, now this is 1889, this is 100 years later, we now know the mischiefs that come from the power of official removal, which were then only dimly apprehended. The power of removal from office belonged, Mr. Madison believed, rightfully to the president. And if by some unhappy chance the wrong man should find his way into the position of president and abuse the power entrusted to him, quote, now quoting Madison, quote, the wanton removal of meritorious officers would subject the president to impeachment and removal from his own high trust, end of quote. You get it? And the only argument against this is, hey, you've got the Senate as a flywheel, as a balance. And Madison said, yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and that's why it's probably unlikely it'll ever happen. And so what happens? Arlen Specter changes the Patriot Act and essentially changes the Constitution. Now, frankly, I don't think this ever would have made it through the Supreme Court if it had gotten that far, but this guy working for Specter who slipped this thing into the Patriot Act fundamentally changed our nature of government. And this goes back to a debate in 1789. Bennett in Los Angeles, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Bennett, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today?
You make a very compelling argument. Another way to approach it, though, at the risk of sounding Republican, is to look at the private sector. Most non-unionized Americans are employed at will, which means they can be fired at any time with or without cause. But there's one caveat. They can't be fired for an improper cause. And that being, you know, discrimination or refusal to participate in crime. And that's kind of the situation we have here. We're not saying the president can't fire someone. We're saying he can't fire someone for an improper purpose.
Yeah, your point is well taken, although I would, to put a fine point on it, the private sector, absent government regulations, because that illegality of firing people because they're the wrong skin color or the wrong gender is actually not a part of the nature of the private market or of corporate administration. In fact, in the history of corporations in the private market is that we have a long history of discrimination, right? That is actually the result of laws, of government.
And courts, as well.
Right, yeah, because private enterprise, free enterprise, is technically, you know, it's modeled on kingdoms, on the old kingdom model, whereas our government is modeled on a constitutionally limited representative democratic republic, and it's a very different thing. But your point is well taken. Exactly. It's not whether or not he has the power to fire. Nobody's disputing that the president has the power to fire. It's whether, to quote James Madison, the wanton removal of meritorious officers is what has happened.
One thing about Congressman Gerry, as a native Rhode Islander, you know, I apologize for his lack of foresight, but Rhode Island should get some credit for being the first state to recognize the separation of church and state in its constitution.
But yeah, and Gerry, and you're welcome. And Gerry was one of the advocates of that. Congressman Gerry was, Eldridge Gerry was actually a very, very good guy. Ralph in Colorado Springs, Colorado, listening on 760 AM. Hey, Ralph.
Hi, Jay. your interpretation is correct because you flip it over. And the flip side basically is the article in Section 1, in Article 1 that deals with impeachment, says, after impeachment, then the impeached person shall be liable and subject to indictment, trial, judgment, and punishment according to the law.
Right.
So, but the thing...
Now, let me just add an interesting point to that, Ralph, and yep. Let you chew on this one for a second. The Constitution was ratified in 1789.
Mm-hmm.
And it was proposed in 1787. So for basically from 1789 or 1787 until 1790, so the 3-year period there, the Constitution is saying that you can impeach a president or anybody for that matter for high crimes and misdemeanors. And yet the first federal crime, the first federally defined crime, was a law passed by Congress in 1790. So at the time of the Constitution, at the time it was being debated, the time it was written, the time it was being debated, the time it was ratified, there were no federal crimes. there were no legal high crimes and or misdemeanors. And so this is what Madison is talking about. We are in the process, he was saying essentially right now, of defining one of those high crimes for which impeachment is the remedy. And in his opinion, one of those high crimes was, quoting James Madison, the wanton removal of meritorious officers. End of quote.
Okay.
So you were going to make a further point.
Yeah. The further point is basically the Nixon loophole.
Right.
And I'll do it this way. I have no idea what the deal is with Gonzalez, whether he's guilty of crimes or not. But let's assume that he's impeached. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The normal operation is, according to Article 1, that he then becomes subject to the full force of law.
Okay, hang on just a second. You're talking about Gonzalez being impeached or Bush being impeached?
Gonzalez. Let's leave it at Gonzalez.
Gonzalez. Okay.
So Gonzalez removes a good official. That is a high crime. He is therefore subject to impeachment. He is then impeached. Okay.
Right.
After impeachment, he loses all immunity. So he gets the normal force of the law for everything else.
That's correct. And it was what should have happened to Nixon, except Jerry Ford.
Right. And that's the Nixon loophole. And the thing is, the reason it's a loophole is that the pardon power granted the president, he can pardon for anything, murder, you name it, except, to quote the Constitution, in cases of impeachment.
Except in cases of impeachment, right. In fact, there are many who still argue to this day that Jerry Ford's pardon of Nixon was unconstitutional, and if the Democrats had chosen at the time to take it to the Supreme Court, that they probably would have prevailed.
Well, and that's why you're going to see, and I know, again, hypothetically Gonzalez, but you're going to see a whole bunch of resignations just before the end of Bush's term and a whole bunch of pardons that are absolute and complete, just like Jerry Ford's.
Oh, yeah. You're
and the only
right
way
rough.
And the only way you can stop that is to amend the Constitution.
Or change. I think you could do it by law. I would not amend the Constitution. I think that there's... First of all, it's very, very difficult to do. There's been over 19,000 amendments proposed to the Constitution since it was first written, and only, fewer than 30 of them have made it their way all the way through the process. And secondly, I think that could be done at law. But your point is well taken, and thank you for the call, and thanks for listening there. Richard in North Bergen, New Jersey, listening to WWRL. Hey, Richard.
Yeah, hi. Wasn't Johnson in 1866 or 67... one of the articles of impeachment against him was, I think, the firing of Secretary of War Stanton.
That's right, Andrew Johnson. And in fact, you know, it's interesting, the impeachment of Johnson was, you know, I think probably most historians would suggest certainly, well, I don't want to put anything in Doris Kearns Goodwin's mouth unless she says it, but my recollection of reading that stuff years ago was that he was principally impeached because he was a Democrat. I mean, Lincoln reached out across party lines and put Democrats in his cabinet and had one as his vice president. And so when he was assassinated, the party of the presidency flipped, and the rest of Congress said, no, we're not going to have this. And, you know, so they went after him because he was a Democrat. But I believe that you're right, that one of the articles of impeachment was that he had fired the was Stanton the Secretary of War at the time?
Yes, he was. But
yeah.
The irony, of course, is that Stanton was found innocent, went back to Tennessee, was elected senator from Tennessee, and went back to the House that impeached him as a senator from Tennessee.
Right. Amazing. Amazing. Richard, thanks for the heads up. Jerry in Long Island. Hey, Jerry, just a few seconds here before we've got to take a break.
Oh, well, I don't know if I could do this in 2 seconds, but, I think we're sort of concentrating. I'm glad you brought up Andrew Johnson and everything, but I think one of the things he was impeached for was conspiring against the Constitution and Congress. But I think there's an important aspect we're missing, and that's the whole firing. We're concentrating too much on the firing. I think we need to look at the replacements. And the
that was Jerry's point. I mean, that's what everybody's point was, Jerry, was that the replacement would have to go before the Senate. And the real crime here is Specter slipping this thing into the Patriot Act, and then the Bush administration using it to elevate to the office of special prosecutor federal prosecutor without confirmation by the Senate. A whole variety of people, including possibly the guy who slipped this into the Patriot Act in the first place. 45 minutes past the hour. Thank you.
In broadcasting, this is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Welcome back. It's the place for being progressive. Never felt so good. The Tom Hartman Radio Program on Air America Radio. By the way, I'll be in the Bay Area this Thursday. I'll be on the air doing my program live from the Quake, 960 The Quake in San Francisco. And then from 5 to 6 p.m., the Progressive News Hour with John Scott from our affiliate, The Quake. We're doing an event at the Little Fox Theater in Redwood City. So if you want to go, you can get details if you're living in the Bay Area at quakeradio.com. There's also, just as an FYI, there's a movie playing in San Francisco that I'm in. It's called Crude Impact. It's playing at the Roxy Theater, 7 and 9 p.m. through this Thursday. Today, tomorrow, Wednesday, and Thursday. Although Thursday night, I'll be down in Redwood City, so I'll drop by. And speaking of San Francisco, Jeff in San Francisco on the line. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Well, I just wanted to, by the way, hello, Tom, and I will try and make it to see you in the Bay Area, but I hope you have a good time. The weather's looking up. So.
Thank you. But speaking of the possibility that a president could be impeached for wantonly removing meritorious officers.
Yes. First of all, I think you made a great case that essentially with this really ill-advised change in the procedure for replacing and doing recess appointments and getting approval of Congress, for firing an attorney, with removing that process and replacing it with this Patriot Act thing that Spector's office did, and shame on him, we basically removed, I think, a check from Congress, and it leaves them with no other choice but, I think, the check of impeachment. I think you make a great argument for that. But then there's a...
Well, actually, James Madison made the argument.
I think that's a great argument. I mean...
We'll defer to him.
Here's the other thing, though. I mean, I think this is the way I've been approaching it, and I haven't heard you mention this yet, but that essentially what Bush and Gonzalez did, at least in a few of the cases of these attorneys, more than one from what I'm aware, although the specifics escape me, is that more than one of these attorneys were fired for their acts in ongoing criminal investigations. And
yes.
These were, we also have the issue of,
that's criminal interference with prosecution.
Absolutely. So there's that as well.
And obstruction of justice.
And I just want to make an aside. I mean, with this recent revelation about Gonzalez and this email that kind of shows that, well, I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, that the man seems to be an inveterate liar. I mean, don't we, we all sort of expect these days, with the bar being set so low on the Bush administration, that they all seem to lie to a certain degree. But, with the attorney general, wouldn't you, want them to lie at least a little bit less than the rest of, the group that they're with? I mean,
one would hope so, Jeff. One would hope so. Good point and well made. Thank you for the call. Scott in Utah. Hey, Scott, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how are you? I have a question. Actually, two questions. The first one is, according to the Constitution and all treaties signed shall become the highest law of the land. And they signed a Patriot Act, this Arlen Specter Clause, subverting the Constitution. It should have no force of law. In other words, in order to ratify these people without the Senate, they should actually have to amend the Constitution to do that.
Yes. Yeah, and that was my point, that this, had this gone before the Supreme Court, it wouldn't have stood up, in my opinion, because it's a clear violation of the Constitution. So not only did these guys, I mean, you could even argue that amending the Patriot Act in the middle of the night in a way that is unconstitutional probably constitutes some sort of a crime, if not a prosecutable crime, certainly the kind of high crimes and misdemeanors that should be impeachable. Good point, Scott. Thank you. Charlie in Portland, Maine. Hey, Charlie, what's on your mind today?
How you doing today? I didn't think that anything happened up here in Portland or in Maine would be of interest or a discussion like this. But yesterday on the front page of our local paper, the Maine Sunday Telegram, they had an article about our U.S. attorney who they say was neither nominated by a president
nor confirmed by the Senate.
She was appointed by a judge. And everybody sort of scratching their head saying, well, does this sort of is this the exception that proves the general point, which I happen to agree, or is it one possible way to flummox the whole argument and give the people in the White House a possible out?
Right. I don't know the answer to that, and I'm not familiar with that case, and I didn't know that any of these
federal prosecutors had been replaced by somebody who was appointed by a judge. I'll have to look into that. Charlie, but thanks for the heads. Go ahead.
Yeah.
That, I'll have to look into that. Thanks for the heads up. I appreciate it. Jackie in Seattle. Hey, Jackie.
Hi, Tom. I have two quick questions. The first is this guy on Spector's staff. Why was he slipped that into the Patriot Act? Why has that man not been charged with an illegal activity? And then
I believe because he is now a federal prosecutor.
Well, why can't he be charged? He did an illegal act.
Well, this is something to ask Senator Spector's office. And frankly, your senator. I mean, you're both of your senators, Murray and Cantwell. Given that they're in your state, I mean, we should all be asking our own senators. I should be asking Wyden and Smith, and so on. Why is it that this action out of Spector's office that apparently Spector was unaware of, it appears to have happened when he was going through chemotherapy, why was it allowed to stand?
Yes. And then also, why are we moving forward as if the Patriot Act, the new Patriot Act, the way it's been changed, is legitimate when it wasn't?
Yeah. Well, I think we should go back to the original Patriot Act and just ask the simple question, did anybody in Congress read this thing before they voted on it? And the answer is no. Well, actually, there was one member of Congress who did actually read it. And he went on the floor of the House and pointed out the fact that he had read it and then voted against it. And that was the only member of Congress who read the thing. And you could argue that therefore it's illegitimate. I mean, I'm not sure that that's a strong constitutional argument, but it's certainly a practical argument. That the Patriot Act is just absolutely wrong. I mean, this is just incredible. Jackie, thanks for the call. Here it is, James Madison. On the floor of the House of Representatives, the 17th of June, 1789, as they're creating the State Department and the Justice Department and the War Department and the Treasury Department. And he says, he just lays it out, the wanton removal of meritorious officers would subject the president to impeachment and removal from his own high trust. 57 minutes past the hour.
Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
So here we have Purgegate, the firing of federal attorneys because they're not going along with the program. You have some 300 prosecutions of Democrats going on nationwide, some 50 prosecutions of Republicans, but that wasn't enough. Fewer than 50, actually. That wasn't enough, because some of those prosecutions of Republicans were quite effective, and it looked like there were more coming. Jerry Lewis was starting to pull his collar out and do a Rodney Dangerfield, and a few other prominent Republicans being a little concerned about what was going on. Tom DeLay, it looks like possibly the investigations into his dealings in Guam and Saipan by a federal prosecutor. And now, this wasn't actually one of the people who got fired. This was a guy who got promoted out of his job. There were a number of these as well. And then there's the whole issue that, to the best of my knowledge, nobody has seriously looked at, and that is, what about the federal attorneys who weren't fired, but who did act as good Republican hitmen for this administration and just, carried along their merry way? Let's turn a blind eye to any kind of Republican malfeasance, and let's look for as many Democrats as we can. The turning of the office of the Department of Justice into a political branch, a political arm of the Republican National Committee, would probably justify flipping the stars on the flag upside down. From the time of the founding of this country until today, one of the major symbols of the upside down five-pointed star is the goat, right? The devil. Now, there are some people who consider it actually a positive thing, and I've heard from them in email. I get your point. But looking at the Uber culture, the larger culture here, isn't it interesting that when you take the five-pointed star on the American flag, right side up, it looks like a person. It's sort of like Da Vinci's, human. It's you have the head at the top, you have the two arms sticking out on the sides, you got the two legs down the bottom. That's the five-pointed star as it is on the American flag. You flip it upside down, you got these two points at the top. Those are the two horns of the goat. You got these two things on the side. Those are the ears of the goat. And you got this thing on the bottom. That's the chin of the goat. The satanic goat. And it's not odd that in 2000, the Republican Party, for their official logo, you can go see it at GOP.com or GOP.org or, you know, any of the Republican websites. The official logo of the Republican Party, they flip the stars upside down. Three stars, you know, the three stars above the elephant. Well, now we're figuring out. Now we can understand why. There is a cult in the White House. And in fact, I mean, this is an example. You talk about single-party rule, how it happened in the Soviet Union, how it happened in Germany in the 30s. That, in my opinion, I mean, if you want the largest frame of all, if you want to step back absolutely as far as you can get and look at this in the most big-picture context of all the big pictures, it's that this is about single-party rule. This is about trying to create at least a generation, if not multiple generations, of single-party rule by the Republican Party. To hell with conservatism, you know, to throw out the ideas of the traditional values, in quotes, of the Republican Party. Now, keeping in mind that that in and of itself is a little difficult to define, because from 1856, when the Republican Party was formed in June of 1856 in Jackson, Michigan, up until the 1880s, arguably as late as 1886, the Republican Party was the Reform Party. It was a progressive party. It was formed in response to the corruption of the Democratic Party, Jefferson's party, which had become the party of slaveholders in the mid-1800s. And so here you had this Reform Party, but by the 1880s, they sold out. And they've been on the dark side ever since. They sold out to the dark side and essentially never went back, bringing us such marvelous things as the Republican Great Depression. And so if this is really all about single-party rule, then you would expect to see this interleaving between government and political party in such a way that the party is used to control the government, and yet the government can't control the party. The party can be used as a barrier to anybody who would want to try to make government open and honest. And in fact, that's just what we're seeing now. As Henry Waxman points out, when Jack Abramoff and White House officials were conspiring to commit the crimes that Abramoff went to prison for. This is quoting Henry Waxman, the congressman from California, to whom I tip my hat daily. He said, in at least one case, the emails indicate that these non-official email accounts were being used because, quote, to put this stuff in writing in their email system might actually limit what they can do to help us, end quote, from Henry Waxman. In other words, Waxman is quoting Abramoff or somebody in Abramoff's circle as saying, we're not going to talk to government officials using whitehouse.gov or whatever, you know, official White House email systems, because those are subject to federal law and the Federal Records Act, and they have to be kept. They have to be archived in case they're ever subpoenaed by Congress. So instead, we'll use private email accounts. We'll use AOL, or we'll use, you know, whatever. Or we'll use the RNC's email accounts. And in fact, it turns out that virtually all of Karl Rove's email is not done on the official White House email service, but about 95% of all of Karl Rove's emailing is done through the Republican National Committee's email account that Karl Rove has. And apparently ditto for a number of other officials in the White House and in the Justice Department. So that may account for the 18-day gap. That during those 18 days, when they were really getting into the criminal conspiracy part of this criminal conspiracy, they just said, let's just not talk about this at all on White House servers, mail servers. We'll just move all this stuff over to at rnc.org instead of at whitehouse.gov. And so Henry Waxman today sent a letter to the Republican National Committee and the Bush-Cheney 04 campaign, who own the email servers that all these guys in the White House and the Justice Department have been using as they hatched this conspiracy to turn the Department of Justice into another branch of the Republican Party. Because remember, it's all about single-party rule here. Henry Waxman sent them a letter that says, and this is an actual verbatim quote from Henry Waxman's letter to the RNC and to the Bush-Cheney 04 campaign, "The emails of White House officials maintained on RNC email accounts may be relevant for multiple congressional investigations. For this reason, the committee directs you to preserve all emails sent or received by White House officials using email accounts under your control. In addition, the committee requests that you or your designee meet with committee staff during the week of April 2, 2007 to discuss the following matters. Who has access to the email accounts maintained by the RNC? What steps have been taken to preserve the email accounts maintained by the RNC that have been used by White House officials? And what assurance can the RNC provide the committee that no emails involving White House, official White House business have been destroyed or altered?" I will make a prediction. Based on what we saw Ali North and others in the White House doing in the Iran-Contra affair, when we were trading arms for hostages at a time when there were no U.S. hostages, and there was the possibility that Congress might look into, well, exactly who were the hostages that you were trading arms for? Because the only time Iran ever held any U.S. hostages was during the election of 1980 when Jimmy Carter was running against Ronald Reagan and George W. Herbert Walker Bush. So why are you now giving them weapons in exchange for hostages when they don't have any hostages? And as that question started getting asked, suddenly hundreds of thousands of documents were being shredded in the White House and in the Pentagon and in the State Department. And the stuff simply never saw the light of day. And they sent out Ali North, and he took a fall for it, and he later got to skip, and among others. And I predict, tragically, that we will probably see the same thing. I'm guessing that all of the RNC emails are already long gone. These guys are not idiots. And if they were planning back when it was Abramoff conspiring with Rove and Tom DeLay to use RNC emails because they are quickly destroyed. They're quickly destroyed now. 16 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone here in the People's Republic of Portland, Oregon. Tom Hartman here with you. Yes, indeed. Henry Waxman saying, we would like you to hang on to your emails, Republican National Committee, Republican Party. Please. As the National Journal notes, according to one former White House official familiar with Rove's work habits, the president's top political advisors does about 95% of his emailing using his RNC-based account. A former White House official speaking on background said that although the RNC had a policy to purge emails after a short period of time, Rove's emails on its system and those of a few other White House aides in sensitive positions were preserved by the RNC, quote, to protect Carl, end quote. Even with a policy of deleting emails from servers, information technology experts say organizations rarely erase data entirely. Interesting. So Henry Waxman, on the 2nd of April, 2007. What is that, next Tuesday or something like that? I don't know. Next Monday. Okay. Wants to have a conversation with the RNC about Karl Rove's emails. Yeah. Meanwhile, White House spokeswoman Dana Perino. This is from the gaggle this morning. Even though both liberal and conservative lawmakers, pundits, members of the media, and the American public, they know it over at the thinkprogress.org blog, are pushing for Gonzalez's resignation, the White House refuses to budge. This is what Dana Perino says. We are not negotiating. We are where we are, which is where we were last week. I can understand why people would think we have not made the right decision, but we think we have. Oh, interesting. The White House finally acknowledges that somebody could understand, that they understand somebody else's position. That, I think, in and of itself is a pretty dramatic statement. A very dramatic statement, actually. Brett Tolman, by the way. Somebody had asked earlier. Brett Tolman is the guy who rewrote the Patriot Act, according to most sources. The U.S. Patriot, this is from Talking Points memo, December 14, 2005. The USA Patriot Improvement and Reauthorization Act of 2005 comes out of conference. At some point during the conference, now this would have been back in, what, February or March of 2006. At some point during the conference, Brett Tolman, counsel of the Senate Judiciary Committee, added Section 502. No, actually, it wouldn't have been at that time. That was when it was signed into law by the president. So this would have been back in the winter of 2005, 2006. At some point during that conference, Brett Tolman, counsel to the Senate Judiciary Committee, added Section 502. The addition eliminates restrictions on the length of service for interim U.S. attorneys and allows future interim attorneys to serve indefinitely without Senate confirmation. And then this from the Salt Lake City Tribune. On Friday, the Senate confirmed him, that would be Brett Tolman, by voice vote as the new U.S. attorney for Utah, replacing Paul Warner as the top federal law enforcement officer in the state. Warner stepped down earlier this year to become a federal magistrate judge. So here you have Tolman replacing a guy who wasn't fired, but who was promoted out of his position. There's a whole lot of speculation here all over the place that Tolman is being groomed to become a federal judge himself. Later, Arlen Specter, in 2003, this back to the Salt Lake City Tribune, in 2003, his work Tolman caught the attention of U.S. Senator Orrin Hatch, Republican from Utah, who at the time was chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Later, Senator Arlen Specter, Republican of Pennsylvania, who took over as judiciary chairman, brought Tolman aboard. For several years, Tolman helped the two senators gain support for the renewal of the Patriot Act, legislation that drew criticism from lawmakers and citizens alike for concerns about constitutional rights of Americans. Tolman says, "The Patriot Act is one of the most misunderstood laws on the books," adding that he recognized a need for checks and balances regarding citizens' rights. However, Tolman said he felt the law was vilified by some. Said he, "The Patriot Act became the embodiment of the fear of the unknown." Interesting. He also has worked with Bill Frist. Tolman has the endorsement of Hatch and Specter. This is from the Desert News. I believe this is a newspaper in Arizona. Tolman has the endorsement of Hatch and Specter, as well as Senate Majority Leader, Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist of Tennessee and Judiciary Committee member Mike DeWine, Republican from Ohio. Two congressional sources familiar with the discussions told the Salt Lake Tribune. Senate Majority Whip Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, has also called the White House on Tolman's behalf. This is really interesting. You know where and when this is going to get really fascinating is Thursday. Thursday is the day, because Kyle Sampson is apparently going to go up to Capitol Hill and testify under oath willingly about all this stuff. And he was Gonzalez's right-hand man. So here we have the whole, you know, the guy at the center of Purgegate. Is he going to do a John Dean and lay it all out? Or is he going to do an Ollie North and proclaim his patriotism and essentially defy Congress? We'll see. 27 minutes past the hour. Your call's next.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Taking action here. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour of the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Or at least clean elections and a good national health care system and good public education and so on and so forth. So I've been corrected, by the way, on Eldridge Gerry. First of all, it's pronounced Gerry, apparently, even though it's spelled G-E-R-R-Y. And he's from Massachusetts, not Rhode Island. Boston Back Bay, his party's redistricting of that is what produced the name gerrymandering. This is from Tom, a professor. I don't know if he wants to be named, so I won't, but a fellow who would know. And, yeah, and my recollection, and I was asking David if we have a copy of What Would Jefferson Do floating around the studio here, and it turns out we don't because it's in my own book. But there were, you know, when the Declaration of Independence was signed, there were two members of Congress, or two, actually later members of Congress, two who were talking, and one was very large and one was very skinny. And the large guy says to the skinny guy, in your case, or maybe it's the other way around, the skinny guy says to the large case, in your case, the hanging will be over in a second. I'll be dancing in the air for an hour, or maybe one of them, you know, I forget who said it to whom, and one of those two, as I recall, was Eldridge Gerry. So, but I may be wrong. We'll track it down. Anyhow, Lou in Union, New Jersey. Hey, Lou.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Just great, but I'll get better. What's up?
It's really good to talk to you. I'm so glad that you're on Air America full time. And I,
Thank you. Me too.
My call was going back to what you just said about the gerrymandering.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was actually one of the authors of the first naked, political grabs for one-party rule. And he's probably a hero to the Bushies. I mean, there was a man who was, out for political disenfranchisement.
Yeah. Well, yeah. What I knew of him was as a signer of the Declaration of Independence, I'll acknowledge that he may have lost his way. I'm not an expert on Eldridge Gerry. So
I was going to say, with all due respect to that previous caller from Rhode Island, not too much praise for the guy.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Thanks a lot. I appreciate setting me straight, Lou. Thanks a lot for the call, Max in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey.
Yes. Guys. Yes. Good afternoon or good morning.
Good morning.
No. Good afternoon, as the case is. Excuse me. This is not an original thought, but if the Democrats weren't in Congress, I think we'd be further down the road to Iran.
And I made that point last week.
I know. That's why I bring it up, and I agree with you. Having said that, and of course we have to keep calling them, and I called Lacey Clay, my congressman today, his office, and pled that he stay on. I mean, he's very big on Iran, about us not going to Iran, yet he voted for this bill.
Right.
I'm going to throw this by you. And maybe if you've ever thought about it before, I think that in the back of a lot of Democrats' minds still is the other shoe dropping. And the other shoe dropping is we get hit again.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's in the back of a lot of Republicans' minds as well.
Oh, yeah.
But in particular, it's one of the things that's causing Democrats to be timid, you mean?
They'll use it as a ball-peen hammer on our foreheads.
Yeah. I think that that's probably conventional wisdom among the Bob Shrum types, the advisors in the Democratic Party. I frankly don't think that that's how it'll play out, though, because the Bush administration,
It's like they own this stuff now. They've been in office for 5 years. It's like with the VA. I was waiting when all the revelations of the horrible conditions at the VA came out. I was waiting for somebody in the Bush administration to say, well, why didn't Bill Clinton fix this? Because, you know, the first 4 years, they blamed everything on Clinton. But this administration has had power long enough, and the Republicans have certainly had power long enough, that they can't blame stuff on Clinton anymore. And so I suspect, and obviously time will tell, and a lot will have to do with how the media plays it. And, of course, the media it tends to be more friendly to Republicans than Democrats in general, because Republicans represent the interests of big business, and most of our media these days is big business. But nonetheless, I suspect that if there is another 9/11-type incident in the United States, that it will be viewed more as a failure of the Bush administration, and all the follow-up is going to be, why didn't they secure our ports? Why didn't they, start checking? I mean, I think they just recently started checking the cargo going on airplanes, on passenger planes, and all that kind of stuff. And so I think that that's going to be the essence of it. Is that it's going to end up being a blame on the Bush administration rather than a blame on the Democrats. Bush, and in fact, one of the things that it might even lead to is a reevaluation of 9/11 itself. Because keep in mind, when Bush came into office, Clinton, Gore, and Sandy Berger said respectively to Bush, Cheney, and Condi Rice, the people who replaced them in those particular job positions, said, yeah, every one of the three of them said, and it's all on the record, said, your number one concern has to be Osama bin Laden. And the Bush administration's response was to ignore Richard Clark, to ignore all the warnings that bin Laden was coming to get us, and to appoint Dick Cheney as chairman of the counterterrorism task force that never got around to meeting until September of 2001. So although 9/11 came, you know, just what, nine months after the end of the Clinton administration, just actually a few days short of 9 months, or maybe just a few days after, 9 months later, the Bushies were able to sort of make it seem, at least at the time, like, you know, hey, if Clinton had been on his toes, this wouldn't have happened. But now, with the benefit of hindsight, we can look back and say, you know, Bush got something like 56 specific warnings against this, that this was coming over and over and over. He was told that this was coming, and he dropped the ball. And now it would be irrefutable. So I think the Democrats need to stop worrying about that, frankly. I agree with your point, and I think that the Democrats need to stop worrying about it. Gloria in Long Beach, California, listening to K-Talk. Hey, Gloria, what's up?
Yes, very glad to talk with you. I think I remember that when Abramoff and Rove were very close, I read someplace or heard that Abramoff's secretary went over to Rove's office to work with him. And could that be a connection with their using the RNC email business?
Yeah,
who could check on that? Would Waxman, is she still working for Rove?
Henry Waxman is a pit bull that you do not want
to
have attached to your pant leg. I'm telling you, he gets a hold of your pant leg, and you're going to be, you know, dragging that pit bull around for a long, long time. And Henry Waxman has got his teeth in.
Well, do you know if she's still working in Rove's office?
I don't. I didn't even know about the specifics of that, and I can't confirm it. But the point is that these guys.
See, I knew something that.
Yeah.
You know everything.
No, I very definitely don't know everything, Gloria. I was wrong about what state Eldridge Gary was from and how to pronounce his name.
Hero. But,
yeah, well, thank you, Gloria. I appreciate your kind words, and thank you for calling in. Here's my guess on that, though, is that, or my take broadly on that, is that these guys are running the White House like the mafia. I mean, you get, you know, I've never seen The Sopranos, but, you know, we're all familiar with the stereotypes in our culture. And certainly I spent 17 years looking into the activities of Santos Traficante and Carlos Marcello and the mob in New Orleans and Florida and Texas and Louisiana. And, you know, these guys would never commit anything to writing. If they communicated with each other, it was in person in places that they knew couldn't be bugged, or through trusted intermediaries who, in some cases, like Johnny Roselli, ended up chopped up into pieces and floating in an oil drum in the ocean. I mean, they were very, very, very careful. And this is, if Rove is using RNC email to conduct business out of the White House, you have to ask yourself, why? Why? Bernice in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening on WPTT. Hey, Bernice, what's up?
Well, haven't seen you since Monroeville when you signed Screwed for me.
Oh, well, thank you for coming to that book signing. That was a lot of fun. We really slammed that bookstore.
Yeah, you did. Another big issue that came to my end of my life, the at-will law. The at-will law was actually expanded in 1892 to say you could be fired for cause, for no cause, and for a cause morally wrong. And that was further,
was this for government employees or for any employees?
Oh, anybody who was an at-will employee.
Because I thought before the Wagner Act, everybody was considered an at-will employee in the private sector before 1935. I may well be wrong on that. I'm not an expert on the history of labor law.
The miserable part of that, for cause morally wrong, was used against my husband. And we were 6 years in court and went to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and we were fighting a $1 billion corporation.
Wow.
And they were going to take it to the U.S. Supreme Court because that thinking is very much in place in New York State. And I found out, I've been trying to write a book about our experience, that a physicist who became an attorney and was seeing co-professors fired cruelly, and he brought forth that in 1892, and I don't have the citation in front of me,
that this came into federal law. That's very interesting. I'll have to look into that, Bernice. I frankly don't know, and I appreciate the heads up. I had thought that basically those first protections, serious protections, were given in 1935 with the Wagner Act, and that they were diluted in 1947 with Taft-Hartley. But, you know, that may just have to do with unions. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. They
say that Richard Corey owns one half of this whole town, with political connections to spread his wealth around. Born into society, a banker's only child, he had everything a man could want, power, grace, and style. But I work in his factory.
And welcome back. It's the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman Program, 9.5 minutes before the hour. In just a moment, we're going to go to Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. But first, Charlie in Brooklyn, you had some information on Karl Rove's secretary?
Yes, Tom, hi. This is in response to Gloria, who called. The woman's name is Susan Ralston, as in Ralston Purina. She was Abramoff's secretary, then went to work for Rove as his deputy. And after Abramoff was indicted, she was euphemistically asked to spend more time with her family. She resigned from the White House to not attract publicity, they said. But she would make an excellent witness for Waxman's committee.
Yeah, I think you're right. I remember that. I remember vaguely now that sequence of events. Charlie, thank you very much for the heads up on that. I appreciate it and for the call. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. TalkRadioNews.com on the line. Hey, Ellen.
Hi. There's some rumors on the Hill that the Senate vote may be postponed on Iraq to the end of the month, and that's because apparently the Pentagon said they didn't need the money right away. So we're not sure whether that's going to happen this week as was planned. But
the Pentagon has $2 trillion missing. Maybe they found some of it.
I think you're right. They went on a scavenger hunt this weekend.
Right. Oh, look at it. It's under a chair here.
Or maybe an Easter egg hunt with some money in it.
Right. It's in Don Rumsfeld's office. He still has an office and a staff there at the Pentagon, doesn't he?
I believe he does.
Yeah,
but I will have to ask Wendy Wang, our Pentagon correspondent. The big news is, of course, that we are going to be hearing from Kyle Sampson, who, as you know, resigned under pressure, and he is going to testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee on Thursday. Now, it's very interesting. Attorney General Gonzalez is apparently going to spend his time this week working on fighting internet child pornography. And Mr. Sampson is going
always a popular cause.
That's
to
a
fight. I mean, you know, that's as safe as you can get, right? It's generic safe. It's like he's going to come out, he's going to spend his weekend in favor of puppy dogs and children.
That's right. But as you know, the testimony that Mr. Sampson is supposed to be give might they are generally thought that his attorney said that it's going to contradict Gonzalez in terms of who was responsible for the firings.
Now here's Mike Allen over at the Politico. He says this was just posted a little bit ago. He says Sampson's not gunning for anybody, according to Friends. He believes that the issue has blown up because the Justice Department had an inadequate system for preparing officials to testify before Congress, his friends say. The friends say Sampson 37 does not plan to deliver bombshells and say that Democrats looking for plots and schemes will be disappointed. Like other Republicans, Sampson will contend there was no underlying sin, just a botched response.
Well, that may be the case, but he is going to answer truthfully to the questions, and apparently some of his questions are expected to contradict what Gonzalez has said in statements, testimony, etc. Meanwhile, of course, Gonzalez is also under some trouble in River City here for those national security letters, and when you put the national security letters with what we learned from the New York Times this weekend about all of those sort of infestations of government and police forces in New York before the Republican National Convention, you have a very interesting confluence of events. And, of course, what hasn't been linked yet is where did the FBI and where did the New York City police connect in terms of the infiltration of some of these groups?
Right, and this was like Operation RNC or something like that was the name for the FBI operation, or for the New York City Police Department, Operation RNC.
That's
and,
right.
And if Karl Rove is using an RNC email address for 95% of his business out of the White House, I mean, this has to raise huge
we
national
got, you know,
security
Victoria
issues.
And I, after you and I talked, we had Victoria ask that question of Tony Snow.
Uh-huh.
And Tony looked at her like she had 14 heads. Well, really? We have, and I forgot to forward it, but we got sort of somebody emailing us this weekend after Victoria, and she went up to Tony, and Tony said, she said, listen, this is a legitimate question, Tony. And Tony said, well, I'll find out. I'll find out. We still don't have an answer to the fact, does Karl Rove use other emails from the White House? Now, you and I know he does, but the White House has not answered that officially on record. We have asked it, and I believe Victoria is going to be following up with that question as well.
Yeah. Well, Henry Waxman, this is up at the top of the Center for American Progress blog, thinkprogress.org. Henry Waxman just sent a letter to the RNC and the Bush-Cheney 04 campaign noting that Karl Rove uses their servers for email and that he wants those emails retained and he wants them to come and testify on Monday before his committee.
They are all someplace in Tennessee. That's where apparently the RNC server lives.
Oh, that's interesting. Bill Frist's backyard.
And I will, for tomorrow, I will send you this list of, it has a list of all the things that may be on this server, all the other campaign things, et cetera, that are on this particular server that is also used by the RNC. Apparently, it is not a fully dedicated RNC server. It shares it with some other sort of campaign groups, probably ARMS, et cetera, of the Republican National Committee.
And on all of this is a guy with top secret security clearance doing government business using these email accounts of private organizations.
Well, the question is, if he's using that, then can executive privilege be used for those documents? And that's a very interesting legal question that I do not have the answer to.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that one either. But, it raises a larger question of, is it, you know, the propriety of it. I mean, if he's doing work for us, for we the people, and we have granted him, you know, these high security clearances on the assumption that the work he's doing is going to be secure, and then he conducts that work on the server of a political party, you have to wonder about how secure the federal government is. I mean, is that a server that you know, Bin Laden could easily hack into?
Well, security is one issue, and then is it covered under executive privilege? Both interesting issues.
Yeah, indeed. Well, I think Henry Waxman has got his teeth into this one. We'll see where it goes. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks a lot, Ellen.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
Presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And welcome back to the place where reason is our lifestyle choice. Tom Hartman here with you. The Associated Press story headline, Senators question Gonzalez's credibility and prosecutors firing. Here's the story in short form. The White House stood by Alberto Gonzalez today, even as support for the embattled Attorney General erodes on Capitol Hill amid new questions about his honesty. Bottom line here, the document dump on Friday. You know, this is a White House tradition ever since Bush came into office. Bad news, Friday afternoon, it gets dumped. So, hoping that it'll get lost over the weekend, and more often than not, it does. It's been a very successful strategy for, going on 6 years now. Anyhow, the document dump on Friday contained a bit of a smoking gun, a memo indicating that Gonzalez had a one-hour meeting in his office to discuss, or at which the topic was discussed, of the firing of these federal prosecutors. These federal prosecutors who had been organized into these categories of loyal to the president and not sufficiently loyal to the president or the party. Anyhow, back to the Associated Press. Three key Republican senators sharply questioned his truthfulness over the firings last fall of eight federal prosecutors. It's three Republicans. Now, with three Republicans out here saying, wait a minute, we've got a problem. Is the White House going to be able to continue to say, you've got Chuck Hagel, you got Lindsey Graham, you've got Republicans out here saying we have a problem here. Here's Trent Lott of Mississippi and Orrin Hatch of Utah reaffirmed their earlier support for Gonzalez. Hatch called Gonzalez an honest man, but added, but let's be honest about it. The Justice Department has bungled this attorney thing. Yeah. Three of the ousted U.S. attorneys Sunday said they have concluded their firings were politically motivated. Former prosecutors John McKay in Seattle and David DeGlacius in New Mexico both said they were rebuked in private conversations for not pursuing Democrats in their states more aggressively in election year investigations. Is it troubling connecting those dots, as Iglesias said? It is troubling connecting those dots, Iglesias said. Bud Cummings, who was replaced as U.S. attorney in Little Rock, Arkansas, by a Karl Rove protege, acknowledged political appointees can be fired for no reason. But in this case, he said, it looks like that authority was delegated down through former White House counsel Harriet Myers, Karl Rove, Judge Gonzalez, and all the way down to a bunch of 35-year-old kids who got in a room together and tried to decide who was the most loyal to the president. So here we've got Arlen Specter, Lindsey Graham, Chuck Hagel, all kind of backing away from this thing really fast. Republicans saying, what's the deal here? Meanwhile, the White House says, we don't care about these Republicans. They're just senators. We're looking out for members of the family here. These are good buddies. These are the close-in buddies. David Stockman, by the way. Reagan's former budget chief. Now, actually, David Stockman, to his credit, was the one who revealed the bankruptcy of Reaganomics, although he then went on to promote it as Reagan's budget director. But he's being charged with fraud. This is an interesting story. David Stockman, this is in the Associated Press, a former top budget official in the Reagan White House, and three other people were charged Monday in an alleged securities fraud case that embroiled one of North America's largest auto parts companies before it collapsed into bankruptcy. He was the former chairman and chief executive of Collins and Aikman Corporation. This is a company out of Michigan. And this is one of the ones that I find most interesting in today's news. Just a, you know, just a quick overview of what's going on here in the news today is the idea that there might be another Ross Perot coming down the road. Here's Mayor Michael Bloomberg, a self-made B with a B billionaire. Or billionaire with a B. This is in the Washington Post. Michael Scheer writing in the Washington Post. New York Mayor Michael R. Bloomberg, a self-made billionaire, has told friends more than once that his definition of good financial planning is to make sure that the check to the undertaker bounces when it's finally time to go. This is a guy who doesn't believe you can take it with you and apparently is not a big fan of leaving it behind for the kids. So the question, how does a billionaire spend all his money before he dies? In Bloomberg's case, again, this in today's Washington Post, Michael Scheer writing, in Bloomberg's case, Bloomberg might just drop a cool $500 million on a long shot bid to become the nation's first modern president from outside the two major political parties. You'll recall there was another billionaire who tried that back in, 92? Mr. Perot. Unsuccessful, but I would say that his lack of success probably had more to do with his unfamiliarity with the political landscape than with his lack of, you know, or his lack of or presence of funding, as Ross Perot, obviously. And Ross Perot, the guy who was actually right about trade in 92, running against Clinton and Bush, who were both wrong about trade. But that's interesting. That means that Bloomberg, who in the last election spent over $100 per voter in New York City to get elected, and in the election before that, it was a real squeaker. Mark Green, who's now the president of Air America, I believe, was running against him, and had not 9/11 not happened just in the year before that, no doubt would have won, but Bloomberg got the endorsement of Rudy Giuliani, who at that time had, the touch of gold and spent a whole lot of money on that race. And so here we have Bloomberg. But Bloomberg now has had, not only does he have this huge media apparatus behind him, Bloomberg News, and not only does he have billions of dollars, when you figure that George W. Bush in the last presidential campaign spent a little less than $500 million, that's $500 million. In total, through the whole thing, that's Bloomberg could write a check for that. Maybe he will. And just, go around the Republican primary apparatus. But primary? We don't need no stinking primaries. So this is the Teddy Roosevelt Bull Moose Party thing. Teddy Roosevelt was vice president and then president of the United States as a Republican. And then after he left office, tried to get back in, created a third party, the Bull Moose Party, and ran as a unabashed progressive and got trashed in the polls. But coming in without a party behind you is a tough one because you don't have the infrastructure. You don't have the people on the ground. You don't have all the people who have party loyalty and things. But it's way too late for Bloomberg, I think, to try to come in through the front door of the Republican Party. Although, I don't know, Newt Gingrich is sitting around saying, at any minute, the Republicans are going to call me up and say, hey, we need you, Newt. We need a savior. And Newt is there to tell them that he's the guy. In fact, he's out there cleaning up his image and, polishing out, admitting that he was having an affair at the same time that he was prosecuting Bill Clinton, impeaching Bill Clinton for lying about having an affair. That at that very moment, as he was giving those sanctimonious speeches on the floor of the House of Representatives, after the speeches, he was going back to his office and getting it on. I guess Tom DeLay is admitting that, too, now. And these guys are all trying to reinvent themselves. I guess that what has happened is that Rudy Giuliani has given them belief in redemption. Here's a guy, he and his wife have six marriages between them. His first marriage to his second cousin once removed. not unlike Newt Gingrich's first marriage to his high school geometry teacher, his high school math teacher. And so, you know, if the Republicans are willing to buy Giuliani, and it looks like they are, then, you know, maybe they'd take Gingrich. Gingrich is thinking, but maybe, you know, maybe Bloomberg. Bloomberg, I think, has a little cleaner CV. He might have the kind of resume that the Republicans would actually really like right now. Tough one. Interesting one to see how that's going to play out. Yes, we are, you know, way, way out in front of this whole thing. But and, of course, Katie Couric going after the Edwardses on 60 Minutes. This was, frankly, in my opinion, tragic. You know, challenging the positive attitude of Elizabeth Edwards. Come on, give me a break. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Tom Hartman here with you. Yeah, who's carrying Limbaugh's water nowadays?
I'm telling you, this is to jumpstart the campaign. This is to see if it'll jumpstart the campaign. And we'll find out the next 3 or 4 days or whatever week if that happens. But this business about this being a surprise makes me think that the leak that was planted today was purposely wrong. To create surprise, make sure everybody thought, oh, we know what's coming, and then have it blown away. The campaign's going to, oh, the campaign's going to go, oh, well, we thought it was going to be suspended. You know, we all get all these press releases in advance of the state.
Yeah, enough. Rush Limbaugh going off on John Edwards. Why? Well, because possibly he's one of the most solid and credible candidates for president of the United States on the Democratic side. And then Katie Couric on 60 Minutes.
Here you're staring at possible death.
Aren't we all, though?
And you're thinking, I don't want to deprive the country of having my husband lead it.
This is really interesting. Here you're staring at possible death. And Elizabeth Edwards responds with the absolutely existential answer, aren't we all? And the answer obviously is yes. We are all suffering from a fatal condition. It's called life. You know, we come from wherever we come from before life, from, you know, arguably death, if death is the absence of life, and into this world, and then we go into death, whatever that means. And that means a million different things to a million different people. But the point is that we're all going to end up there. No one here gets out alive, to paraphrase or quote Jim Morrison. And Elizabeth Edwards is simply saying that to Katie Couric. Katie just doesn't even notice the comment.
That would be my legacy, wouldn't it, Katie? That I'd taken out this fine man from the possibility of giving a great service. I mean, I don't want that to be my legacy.
No, it's a brilliant answer. But just the unrelenting negativism of the 60 Minutes piece here with Katie Couric and John and Elizabeth Edwards is startling, is the best word that I can come up with for it.
Even those who may be very empathetic to what you all are facing might question your ability to run the country at the same time you're dealing with a major health crisis in your family.
This is a variation on the can you walk and chew gum at the same time, sir, argument. We think you can't, implicit in the question. As if nobody has ever dealt with these things before. This is like saying to Abe Lincoln, well, your son died. Maybe you should just give up. That kind of thing.
Well, all I can tell you is I know from my own life experience that I could do it. I don't have to guess about that. Second, people will be able to watch during the course of this campaign. and I ask them to watch.
Can you understand their concern, though?
Oh, we're going to come back to it again, huh? Here, Katie, okay.
Senator Edwards, that at a time when we're living in a world that is so complicated and so dangerous, that the president cannot be distracted.
Hmm. Interesting. And, you know, I get it that, you know, Katie Couric has had more than her share of disaster in her life, and so you can understand her perspective. I'm not frankly here. I guess, when I opened the segment, it sounded like I was accusing her of carrying Rush Limbaugh's water. I retract that officially. But I think that this morbid, negative, putting the most negative memes out there possible. Well, the good side of it, I suppose, and probably the CBS 60 Minutes would argue this, is that by putting the most negative stuff out, you give John Edwards an opportunity to rebut it, and he does.
By, rightly so, caring about his wife's situation.
I care about her situation. I love her, and I'm going to always care about her situation. But I understand that I have a responsibility to this country. It's why we're doing this. And that responsibility includes the ability to focus and have clarity when hard judgments have to be made. I am completely convinced that I can do that, and it's for the country to determine whether they agree.
And you know, Katie has to, comes back to it one more time here. So.
You said this weekend, I am definitely in the race for the duration. If you want to give the honest answer, how can you say that, Senator Edwards, with such certainty?
How can you say that with such certainty?
God forbid Elizabeth doesn't respond to whatever treatment is recommended, if her health deteriorates.
And his response basically is I'm in this. I'm saying this right now. I'm in this for the duration.
Can you really say that?
We have every reason to be optimistic right now. I believe in my heart and soul that Elizabeth is going to do well. I do believe that. She will be out there campaigning with me and separately. If you ask me today whether I'm in this campaign for the duration, the answer to that question is yes.
So I'm still kind of quite ambivalent about this whole interview. You know, was Katie really asking the tough questions that America needs to have somebody out there uncomfortably ask? Or was it an attempt to plant negative memes about the Edwards? Probably the former. Probably the former. 27.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Sometimes I feel a little mad, but don't you know that no one alive can always be an angel? When things go wrong, I seem to be bad. I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. Let's take a quick look at what's going on with the ongoing U.S. occupation of Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lights in the balance. There are people on the fire.
Following our security developments in Iraq as of 1500 hours GMT on Monday, these compiled by Reuters, Dateline Baghdad, gunmen killed an advisor for the Sunni Endowment, an organization which manages Sunni religious sites, along with two other employees in a drive-by shooting in Ahmadiyya in northern Baghdad. In Baghdad, a rocket landed in Baghdad's heavily fortified international green zone on Monday, rocking the U.S. embassy but causing no casualties. In Baghdad, at least four people were wounded when a rocket landed on a house in the district of Karada in central Baghdad. In Hawija, police killed a gunman and arrested another when they were trying to plant a roadside bomb. In Tikrit, police found the bullet-riddled body of a man in that town. In Baghdad, a suicide bomb killed two civilians and wounded five more in Rushafa near the Shorjah market in central Baghdad. In Baghdad, a mortar round landed on a residential district in Dora in southern Baghdad, killing a man and wounding three others. In Mosul, gunmen killed a police major in that northern city. In Mosul, a decapitated body was found in Mosul on Sunday. Another body of a man with gunshot wounds was found also on Monday in Mosul. In Iskandaria, a curfew was imposed in that town south of Baghdad after clashes erupted between gunmen and security forces. Mortars also landed in a central residential district, killing two and wounding four. In Baghdad, Iraqi soldiers killed six suspected insurgents over the last 24 hours. In Baghdad, Brigadier Qasim Mousawi, spokesman for the Baghdad security plan, said Iraqi forces captured a senior al-Qaeda leader and two of his aides. In the Abu Ghraib area, northwest of Baghdad. In Tal Afar, Iraqi police raided a house in Tal Afar near the Syrian border and shot a man wearing an explosive vest, which detonated, killing himself and another insurgent. In Baghdad, a roadside bomb targeting a police patrol killed a policeman and wounded three others. In Baghdad, 17 bodies were found on Sunday. In Mosul, gunmen killed tribal leader Mohammed al-Igud and wounded his son. And near Kut, gunmen killed an Iraqi contractor working for the U.S. forces in a drive-by shooting. In Mosul, gunmen killed a Force Protection Service captain. And in Diwaniya, the body of a man was found with gunshot wounds, bound, and bearing signs of torture. Just another day in the wonderful world of George W. Bush's burgeoning democracy. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room and say hi. Debbie in Hazlitt, New Jersey, rather. Hey, Debbie, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi, Tom. Good to talk to you. I really love your show. I wanted to call up and comment about the Katie Couric segment.
Yeah.
Earlier in the day, I was, you know, catching the Sunday morning chatter on the news programs, and I believe it was on the Bob Schieffer show where they had several gentlemen on. Anyway, they were talking, like, from the Republican point of view, and they were really talking about this John Edwards thing and his wife, and really pushing home that the thing to do is to put the doubt in the people's minds that how can he be divided, you know, like, because if he goes for the presidency, it looks like he's being insensitive to his wife's needs, and then
right.
The Republicans can all jump on that. And if he's dedicated to his wife, then he's not doing his job, and that's
right.
Going to be their talking point.
How dare somebody who's confronting serious health issues with themselves or with their spouse consider running for the presidency? FDR did it just fine from a wheelchair and died in office his last term. I think he probably his people around him said that he knew he probably wouldn't live out his last term, but he fought for it anyway.
And there was another program on about, you know, the fact is that she has breast cancer and that her treatment, you know, her condition is treatable. She
right.
could live quite a while. And the other thing is that a lot of Americans, what is it, 1 in 4 people have cancer?
1 in 3 will experience it at one point or another in their lives.
So we already know, you know, like what he might be going through and probably has, you know, the ability
yeah.
to do two things at once.
Well, hopefully. And Katie Couric, and thank you, Debbie. Hey, Katie, you know, went through that with her husband and I believe with her sister as well. So I don't know, maybe there's some... I don't want to get into psychobabble on Katie Couric. I don't know her. Winifred in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
I wanted to thank you for bringing up the Katie Couric interview. I thought she was simply appalling. I cannot believe that CBS let her do that rather than Leslie Stahl, for instance, or someone else. I thought it was, and I think the woman who's just spoken has a bit of political insight. I was just looking at it from a human point of view, didn't think of it too much politically, but God.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, thank you very much.
Yeah. You're welcome. Thank you, Winifred. Thanks for weighing in on the topic. Brian in Manchester, New Hampshire. Hey, Brian, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I got that quote about the large man, Virginia's Benjamin Harrison, talking to the short, thin men from your book, What Would Jefferson Do? Was from Chapter 3, People and Events That Influenced America's Founders, on page 53. But first, I just want to mention real quick, John Edwards, you know, if he runs his spirited, uplifting campaign, that's his trademark anyways, that alone, you talk about mental health before, influencing physical health, et cetera, that if he, that alone, that would, if he runs a spirited campaign, that alone will lift and lengthen the life of his beloved wife by lifting her spirits as well.
I agree. Yeah. One of the things that we've discovered in the last decade or two is
that
the...
Why don't they talk positively in that sense? Why don't these so-called...
Yeah, absolutely, is that the immune cells in the body actually have receptors on their surfaces for serotonin, for these neurotransmitters that are associated with good mood and positive, you know, positive thinking.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it's, you know, the Norman Cousins experience was not an anomaly, so was it Eldridge Gary?
Yeah, he
was the skinny guy?
Virginia's Benjamin Harrison, who weighed nearly 300 pounds, commented to Massachusetts Elbridge Gerry, a short, thin man, with me, the hanging in brackets, will be all over in a minute, but you'll be dancing on air an hour after I'm gone, end quote. And he goes on to talk about John Hancock, too. There's great words about the loss, the sacrifice our patriots, founding patriots made, Tom, if I could read it real quickly.
Actually, no, Brian, but I appreciate the call, but we just don't do reading on the air here, but people can find it in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? Not to plug the book, but it's, you know, it's out there. There are a lot of good sources about the sacrifices of the founders. And it's also a topic that perhaps we'll revisit as a topic on the program right now. But there's people who want to weigh in on a few other issues here. Raj in Queens, New York. Hey, Raj, what's on your mind today?
Thank you, Tom. You're doing a good job and you're a great American, Tom.
Thank you.
Tom, I have a question regarding Kerry Kellogg's interview of Edwards and his wife, and I have a question towards it, that what was she doing when her husband had a cancer?
Katie Couric?
Yes.
I don't know, but, you know, I think
she didn't leave her job, she didn't do anything special.
Well, you know, but there's a difference. There is a fundamental difference between running for president of the United States and being a, you know, a TV star or an anchor person or having a job, period. And I don't think that it's inappropriate for Katie Couric to ask hard questions that reflect the thinking of some people in America. Where I think it became painful for a lot of us watching was when those questions kept getting hammered over and over and over and over again, to the point that it almost seemed like it was the mantra, the talking points, that there was no window there for joy or hope or positiveness, and that she didn't want to get into the issues of the campaign.
I understand your point, but my point is, like, American president is not a person, it's an institution.
Right.
You know? So
yeah, that's my point. That's why I'm saying that somebody running for the presidency is held to a different standard than somebody, you know, who simply has a job
That's why it's possible for Edward to run and govern the country properly, because it's an institution.
Oh, I see. So what you're saying is that he should therefore get more of the benefit of the doubt and have a little more latitude than somebody like Katie Couric, who could have taken time off from work or whatever.
That's correct.
That's an interesting take on it, Raj. That's very interesting. Thanks a lot for the call. John in Washington, D.C. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. A little bit more about Katie Couric. I've been watching 60 Minutes, like, since 1970 when I came home from the service. And I even watched the reruns in the summer. And the way that Katie Couric was asking the questions, if you look at her face, she had kind of a scowl. She was kind of like setting up, I'm not going to believe what you're going to tell me here, but here's the question. And the way she kept on coming back at it, I think there was malintent in the interview. And I've already called up CBS.
Yeah.
And told them that when I see Katie Couric coming on the show, I'm going to turn it off.
That's interesting. It'd be interesting to know how many Americans, you know, what the general perception of that interview was. That's very interesting. John, thanks a lot for the call and for the comment.
Politics, as you know, can be a cynical business.
No.
Listen to the tonality.
I was not aware of that.
Glad I'm teaching you something today. And some have suggested.
Some have suggested
that you're capitalizing on this.
Here's what I would say.
Some have suggested.
First of all, there's not a single person in America they should vote for me because Elizabeth has cancer.
No. And then he goes into a positive, a whole positive thing. But yeah, some have suggested, have you watched Outfoxed? That's what Fox News does when they're going to smear somebody. They say, well, some say. Interesting. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be right back with your calls.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Multinational corporations would really rather you weren't all that familiar with. Tom Hartman here with you. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Jim in San Diego, California. Welcome to the program, Jim.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for everything you do.
You're welcome. Thank you for calling.
On this Katie Couric issue, I have to wonder if you're at least as concerned that we have a vice president that's at death's door as opposed to a potential first lady with a relatively minor health problem.
Right. Well, or a major but treatable health problem, let's say.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you've got a vice president who's had several heart attacks, who has a pacemaker, and who now has blood clots. That's, you know, and no mention of that. Interesting. Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Ann in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Ann.
Hi, Tom. About Katie Couric, I don't understand why people are so hesitant to ascribe partisan motives to her. When I was disgusted by her in 03 and 04 when she was still hosting the Today Show with Matt Lauer, and she did an interview of, I think it was John Kerry before the election, and it was it was Matt Lauer who did. It was really, really tearing into him. And so I sent an email because I'd finally had enough of that show, and I said, I'm not watching you guys anymore. You're too partisan. And they sent me an email back saying, thanks for watching the show. We can't respond to all of our emails. And this was an email account that I kept very, very private, and basically nobody had it. I had a couple of bank accounts on it. Well, the next email I got after the one from the Today Show was one from the RNC, in which they had some kind of video they'd put together about how Democrats had also supported going into Iraq.
Oh, that's interesting. So NBC was selling their email list.
Pardon? I don't know.
Whichever network the Today Show is on, I forget which network it is.
The Today Show. I think
CBS.
NBC provided my
NBC,
email
yeah.
to the RNC.
CBS. Yeah, that's interesting, Ann. I'm not surprised, frankly, because that kind of thing, you know, frankly, happens all the time, and there's a whole industry devoted to simply acquiring email addresses. You know, send you spam, and then it says, you don't want this? Click here to unsubscribe. You click there to unsubscribe, and so now you're no longer getting the offer of the free Lego toy, but now you're getting 45 other offers. They actually did unsubscribe you from that list, which you were never on, but now they've got your address, and they know that it's real, and so they're going to go after all these other things. Dan in San Diego. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Yeah, I had one point, but before that, I wanted to jump on the Katie Couric issue. I thought the questions she asked may have been somewhat relevant, but she belabored the point. But I suppose
my sense of it. It was just the tone and the repetition was just too much. Thank you very much.
Yeah, yeah, and I think in a sense it may be a diffused, looking at the silver lining, may have diffused questions that may come up later. But I mean, like different people, handle adversity differently. You know, there's no one size fits all. I mean, what about Gerald Ford and Betty Ford? She had breast cancer.
Yeah. And, although not when he was running for office. I mean, that was after he left the presidency, as I recall.
Yeah, that's true. But anyway, what I called about was about the emails from the Attorney General. What about all that data mining software and that AT&T setup they had to filter all the emails? They shouldn't have any trouble finding all those old emails from Alberto Gonzalez. And wouldn't that be poetic justice?
That's an interesting point. Yeah, if the illegal NSC program, or NSA program, rather,
right.
had snatched all of Gonzalez. That's great, Dan. Thank you very much. That's amazing. Alice in Columbus, Georgia. Hey, Alice, welcome to the program.
Hey, I just want to say you and Henry Waxman are our new heroes. You for speaking the truth and him for his bulldog tenaciousness. But what I want to say is, if Congress doesn't now have enough offenses on the list to impeach Bush and Cheney for their crimes against the Constitution, then we might as well throw out the Constitution. We're not a constitutional government anymore. And these are just the things they've already uncovered. God help us when we find out what hasn't been uncovered yet.
Yeah, it's real interesting to see how much it takes, Alice, and thank you for the call. How much it takes, you know, how much it took for Republicans to start screaming impeachment. They started, I think, screaming impeachment with Whitewater, and then Filegate, and then Travelgate, and then, you know, it was like over and over and over, and, oh, we'll impeach him for this, no, we'll impeach him for that. Oh, wait a minute, Monica, holy cow, a cigar involved? Oh, my God. And you know. Yeah, but the Democrats, they're very careful with that word. John in Santa Clara, California. Hey, John.
Oh, hi, Tom. Been on hold for a while. I just wanted to know, there's been a lot of talk about the inevitable end of the Iraqi war, and I wanted to just kind of ask you if you'd like to see what the outcome, if you agree with the timeline vote. I don't think we've ever heard you speak to that, maybe. Would you like to see war reparations? Would you like to see a Marshall plan?
Yes, I think a Marshall plan of some sort is going to be necessary. And it has to be without any U.S. contractors whatsoever. It has to be completely indigenous, the same way it was in Germany, where you rebuild the industrial infrastructure by giving them the money to rebuild themselves. And we need to undo the changes that we made to the Iraqi Constitution that threw them from being a republic, basically, even though it was run by a dictator, from being a republic into being a neocon free trade zone, essentially, you know, where all the barriers, all protectionist barriers were thrown away, and all employment barriers or all employment protections were thrown away, and multinational corporations could come in and own 100% of anything, and expatriate, take out of the country all their profits and have to leave nothing behind. I mean, none of these are things that most nations would ever consider doing. This was supposed to be the great neoconservative experiment. These guys saw what Truman and Marshall did in Europe after World War II with the Marshall Plan, and how successful they were rebuilding Europe. And they said, that was just an anomaly. That was just because the Germans are so hardworking and the Japanese are just, you know, that was just an anomaly. It had nothing to do with the fact that they gave them strong trade unions and national health service and all that kind of. We'll create a neoconservative paradise in Iraq, and we'll show you how successful it'll be. And they did. And it is. Exactly. Anyhow, coming up tomorrow on the Tom Hartman program here, Charlie Rangel is going to be by about a national service program. Conservative Richard Ralston and I are going to shake it up over health care, that and the best of the news, and, of course, your calls, as always, here on the Tom Hartman program. Thanks so much for being with us, and don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.